Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elby.
And I'm Ken Reardon. And Ron, Thursday night, another debate. The Republicans are meeting in Orlando, Florida, including...
At last,
Gary Johnson.
Well, let the excitement be unbounded.
Okay, but all citing a kid. Obviously, the debate Thursday night, we're doing this, of course, Thursday morning. So, of course, the listener will probably...
We don't know as much about the debate as we would like to.
Well, except we do know that the focus, once again, probably for the third consecutive debate, will be Rick Perry versus Mitt Romney.
Yes, and especially on Rick Perry, because the other candidates will also be firing at Perry, not so much at Romney anymore. It's become pointless, really, for most of them to even go after Romney. They're all aiming at the front runner at this moment. And I'm not sure that he is that dominant a front runner. You know, his numbers are clearly better than anybody else's. And we assume that if Sarah Palin never gets in and nobody else gets in, that a lot of these other candidates, as they fall out, will see their support go to Rick Perry. That's what really makes him the guy they have to go after now.
True, but of course, once upon a time, we were talking about Mitt Romney as the guy everybody needs to go after because he was the ostensible front runner because his numbers were the best in the polls and with fundraising. Mitt Romney seems to be not so much a forgotten person, but certainly not the one with the target on his back going into the debate in Orlando. It just dawned on me.
It just dawned on me. I understand, Tony. Yeah. Does Gary Johnson make any kind of difference in this debate at all?
Does he just come in
and reiterate some of the things Ron Paul is saying and say, but I'm younger?
And more boring. He doesn't know. Gary Johnson, sadly, I mean, we saw him in the May debate. He just had nothing to add. But you know something we keep talking about? First of all, there's a new poll that just came out. Suffolk University came out this week.
I just saw that poll.
New Hampshire, and then Mitt Romney with a huge lead in New Hampshire.
What do we make of the Suffolk poll? And I want to remind you that the Suffolk poll was the only poll that nailed it in 2008 and showed that Hillary Clinton was going to come back and beat Barack Obama.
Yes, but when was that poll taken?
Well, that was taken right before the primary, and that's, of course, why they nailed it. But they are
well, not. I mean, we're talking about 4 months in advance now.
But they may be nailing what's going on right now in New Hampshire. If so, that would contradict a lot of what we're hearing elsewhere.
Well, yes, but here I go again, because 4 years ago this time, what people were hearing in New Hampshire was Mitt Romney with a huge lead, followed by Rudy Giuliani, and I think John McCain, who ultimately won the primary, was fourth or fifth. The point is, yes, Mitt Romney does have a huge lead. What I thought was more interesting about this is that Ron Paul finished second, John Huntsman finished third, and Rick Perry finished fourth.
Now, can you believe that? Can you believe that New Hampshire is really rejecting Rick Perry in that kind of fashion? Most of the comments that I'm hearing from people out of New Hampshire, certainly in the party hierarchy and some small smattering of the state legislature and so on, are much more positive about the prospect of Perry.
Well, I think so, too. And I think for all the discussion about how much he has hurt his cause with comments about Social Security and the HPV vaccine and how his campaign contributors have benefited in Texas, but I don't think his numbers have gone down. They have vis-a-vis President Obama. It seems like the head-to-head polls I've seen the last couple of days, Mitt Romney still has a 6-point lead or so against Obama, whereas the president and Rick Perry are basically tied, if not with a slight Obama lead. The point is, but among Republicans...
You're saying Romney has more appeal to independents.
Right, in general election vote, and I think that's been the argument from day one. Is it somebody who could beat Obama, or is it somebody who's truer to Republican principles? And if the latter is the case, then Rick Perry should probably not be in bad shape.
Does that devolve then to a question of whether the Republicans think they've got this thing and they, as long as they don't blow it by nominating the wrong person, they're going to win? Or are they in a kind of headspace where they think they need just the right candidate in order to beat the incumbent?
I think both are true, and we saw this, for example, in the Pennsylvania scheme, and I say scheme advisedly, but the scheme to change the way electoral votes
are split between winner and loser.
Right, yeah. Right. In Pennsylvania, a lot of Republicans are saying don't do this because, first of all, the thought is the reason Republicans want to change the way electoral votes are allocated in Pennsylvania is because it's a Democratic state. They've won it every year since Clinton in 92. The Democrats have 5 times in a row. But some Republicans are saying, wait a second, we could beat Obama. We could beat him in Pennsylvania.
That's what the numbers say.
Exactly.
That's what the polls show.
So I'm thinking if the Republicans are confident that they can win in November 2012, why not go with somebody who might be closer to their own personal position?
Well, then that raises the question of what is closer to the actual Republican position, because I think there are probably quite a few Republicans who are disturbed at some of the things they're hearing from Rick Perry. Not the Tea Party, perhaps, but the rest of the Republican Party, the kind of people who would vote in 2012 who might not have voted in 2010, or Republican-leaning independents who are equally important to the Republican Party. And those
equally
people,
important? I wonder about that.
That's a question. That is a question, because the Tea Party energy does seem to be so representative of where the Republican Party is today, where the Republican mind is today. But is that really, in the end, the reality of the voting public when we get to the actual primaries and we get to November of 2012, or is it more representative of the people who are making a lot of noise about politics when it's not an election year? The more intensely interested, if you will.
Well, except there's an election year very soon. I mean, we think of 2012 being a long time away from now. But, for example, if Florida moves up its primary to the middle of February, then Iowa and New Hampshire are obviously going to have to move back into January. So we could be talking about 3 months away from this whole thing starting.
That's right. Florida is going to announce sometime in early October whether or not they're going to firm up their plans to move up their primary and get outside of the window of allowance. That could, we've discussed this before, that could move the entire primary and caucus process back before the holidays into early December. But we don't know if that's going to happen. We don't want to put up any scare tactics or hysteria. But there is still that prospect.
One thing we do know, I mean, that is still on the schedule is this Saturday in Orlando, we'll have a Republican straw poll. Now, we did see the big straw poll
this
in Ames.
This is referred to as, catchy name, P5.
P5.
And it's called that because?
Because it's Presidency 5.
It's the fifth time they've had a presidential poll of this kind.
Here's the thing. I mean, many Republicans are saying this may be more demonstrative or representative of the Republican true feelings than it was in Iowa. Yes, Michelle Bachmann did win the Ames straw poll in Iowa in August, but at the time, everybody had to pay to play.
It's an organized event.
It is, but you also had to pay to play, whereas everybody, basically the people who are voting in Florida are all the party alumni and top officials, and it seems to be more representative of the party. But regarding the argument about whether you want somebody who can win or somebody who's true to the principles, that was the argument used against Florida Governor Rick Scott in 2010, that he was not supposed to win the primary because he had so much baggage, and yet Republican voters in the primary still picked him over Bill McCollum, who was supposed to be a stronger candidate in November.
Although Bill McCollum, let's face it, is a perennial candidate in Florida. He has run statewide a number of times and been rejected. He can't really make the argument that he's more electable in November when he's lost in several Novembers.
There's truth to that. But the feeling was there was so much baggage on Rick Scott. And so maybe the argument that Rick Perry is not electable because of controversial statements he's made and gaffes he's made, maybe the media are focused on that. Maybe the rank-and-file Republicans are not.
I think you make an excellent point. Rick Scott had a lot of baggage in the media, with the media, but it wasn't necessarily the kind of thing that was bothering the average voter in Florida, as we saw in November. Now, since then, his numbers have kind of tanked, and he's done a lot of unpopular things, and he may not be more than a one-term governor, but at least for the excitement of 2010 on the right, he was exactly the right kind of guy. Right now, it looks like Rick Perry has captured what previously Michelle Bachmann had captured, perhaps Sarah Palin at some point had captured, could capture again. And that's that excitement, that sense on the right that they are on the march, in much the same way that people in the Democratic Party, younger people, minorities, felt they were on the march in 2008.
And Rick Perry also made headlines this week by basically attacking the president on Israel and the Mideast peace negotiations, or lack of same, while the president is about to go to the UN.
Yes, and Rick Perry stood on a stage, not only with a group of American politicians like Bob Turner, the new congressman from Brooklyn and Queens, but also a group of Israeli politicians, including their deputy speaker of the Israeli Knesset.
I mean, very right-wing.
Very right-wing people, but nonetheless, they are officials of the Israeli government. And there they are with Rick Perry, and he is challenging, in essence, the right of the President of the United States to go to the United Nations and speak for the United States. Now, maybe we're way past that era where we used to care about politics and partisanship ending at the water's edge, unquote, as some famous Republican once said. But maybe that's the kind of thing also that undercuts this president in the eyes of other world leaders, in the eyes of other world communities, and in the eyes of the United Nations itself.
Which is so remarkable of the different ways President Obama has seen on this, because if you talk to the people aligned with Rick Perry and the conservative Republicans, and if you talk to the voters of the 9th Congressional District in Brooklyn and Queens, as we talked about in New York.
Particularly the Orthodox Jews.
Well,
not necessarily all the voters, but the Orthodox Jews.
But it was obviously a key issue that and if you talk to Ed Koch, the former mayor of New York.
He was a factor.
He would tell you that President Obama is selling out Israel and is betraying our closest ally in the Middle East. But if you go to the UN, you hear from a lot of countries that said the U.S. is so closely tied with Israel that they've lost their objectivity and they've lost their ability to broker a settlement.
So the speech that the president wound up giving to the General Assembly was a pro-Israel speech. It might have been balanced from the standpoint of the administration, but it played as the president being forced to wrap his arms around Israel again and say, we're going to veto this resolution granting statehood in some sense or another from the United Nations to the Palestinians. And that really unbalances his position. It forces him to restate what has been a longstanding position for the United States, but it also thrusts away all those other elements that you were talking about in the world community.
It also negates the argument that Barack Obama made when he was running for president in 2008, that he, unlike Bush and his cowboy diplomacy, he would be widely respected on the world stage, and yet it seems like, at least by going by the reaction at the UN, the U.S. seems to have fewer allies than ever.
Well, it may not be fewer than ever, but we may not have built substantially on where Barack Obama found our standing when he became president. We may have slightly different reasons, but he hasn't been able to advance the American cause the way he thought he would be able to as some kind of peacemaker on a worldwide scale. One more frustration for him, but only one of many. This week he came out with his jobs plan and also his list of ways to reduce the debt and the deficit, and he challenged the Super Committee of 12 on Capitol Hill to save trillions of dollars off of the deficit. He also struck a rather combative tone and said that he would veto anything that came out of Congress that cut Medicare benefits and did not also include some kind of a price to be paid by the wealthiest. He wants a special tax on millionaires.
And you know that's not going to pass at all. So basically, I mean, there's no way a tax on millionaires is going to pass Congress.
Why is a tax on millionaires not going to pass
Congress? Because John Boehner stood up and said it's not going to pass Congress. And of course, John Boehner doesn't always speak to his caucus, as we learned this week with the stopgap
the stopgap spending bill,
which he lost on,
with disaster relief and other pretty big popular things.
But
on it.
But they are absolute about taxes. And so if the Republicans...
Even a tax on millionaires, even though polls show that well over 60% of the people in the country think that the wealthiest Americans ought to be paying more.
Right.
And why is that? Why are they so defiant of public opinion on this when they talk about public opinion so often with regard to everything else?
Well, because it's exactly what they were elected on. They were elected on reversing decades of politics as usual. They were elected...
Who is they at this point?
They, the Tea Party conservatives.
But John Boehner's not a Tea Party conservative.
No, but we clearly have seen that, first of all, he would not be Speaker of the House without the Tea Party, and the Tea Party is not going to allow the John Boehners and the establishment Republicans to continue what they've been doing all along with the rest of the Congress.
I recognize that there's a difference between what people tell a pollster and what people do when they get in the voting booth. There is a tendency for people to say, yeah, let's tax the rich more when they are talking to a pollster, and then we see an election in which taxes, particularly taxes at the high end, are an issue, and the results seem to go the Republicans' way. I think that's what they're looking at. I think Boehner and the rest of them are saying, well, whatever the polls say, when it comes to an election, we'll frame the issue so that any tax increase on anyone is a tax increase perceived to be on everyone.
Yeah, but we're digressing a little bit, but we seem to, every time there's a special election, there's another message. A few months ago, when Chris Lee's district in New York was basically decided on Paul Ryan's position of privatizing Medicare. That was, you know, obviously that meant that
was the hot button of the moment.
Right, and Democrats were definitely going to take back the House in 2012.
So what's the hot button out of New York 9? Is it Israel or is it gay marriage? Well, or is it the people are disillusioned with Barack Obama?
See, that's what it is. But as disillusioned as they are with Barack Obama, you also see Congress getting 12%, 13% approval ratings.
And if Congress were running for re-election, it would lose.
And that's why my argument is that Rick Perry and Mitt Romney are the two candidates who have nothing to do with Congress, not associated with Congress, do not come from Congress, so at least they don't have to defend, as Bob Dole had to do unfavorably in 1996.
Okay, but just to get the conundrum clear here, if Congress had to run for re-election, supposedly 12% of the people in the country would vote for Congress. But how many incumbents who run for re-election in 2012 do you believe will be re-elected to the House?
Give me a percentage.
Yeah, give me a percentage.
96%?
Yeah, okay, that's a little higher than 12, isn't it?
Yes.
Just a bit of a conundrum, a problem we have
that's
to explain.
Of course, that's not including the member versus member thing that's going on
because
of redistricting.
That's right. You can consider either one of those a winner since they're both incumbents. All right. A couple of other quick notes on Congress. Some people who, against all reason, apparently want to join Congress and be part of that 12% popular group.
Well, one of them is, we've heard from before, Linda McMahon in Connecticut. She's the former wrestling executive who spent $50 million of her own money in 2010. And nonetheless,
and won, right?
Lost 50 by million 12 points to Richard Blumenthal.
12 points? Yeah. To a guy who had admitted that he'd fudged it up about his Vietnam
and
War
even
record?
He admitted anything.
In 2010?
In a Republican year. But
okay.
Of course it was.
So why does she win in 2012?
Why did she win the nomination, or what did she win in November?
Okay, first, why did she win the nomination? Right? Should she be a laughingstock after 2010?
Well, no, because $50 million turns a lot of heads, and Chris Chase is not somebody who excites the Republican faithful.
Former Republican member of Congress.
Who was when he lost in 2008, that ended briefly.
Republicanism in New England.
In New England.
The entire Red Sox nation was Democratic. I still can't believe that that happened. And, of course, it was reversed in 2010 to a large degree.
So, anyway, she has a big lead over Chris Shays, but I think the Democrats keep that seat, although actually they don't keep the seat because Joe Lieberman has it, and he's an independent.
Yeah. Okay. Well, whatever you want to call Joe Lieberman.
Right.
But don't do it on this podcast.
Exactly. Chris Murphy, Congressman Chris Murphy, who's a likely nominee, or Secretary of State Susan Bicewicz, but Democrats win that seat, yes.
But we don't feel the same way about another one of my home states, Wisconsin.
Well, Tommy Thompson, the former four-term governor of Wisconsin, once upon a time was Mr. He was politics and very popular in the state.
Enormously popular.
But
three of those four wins were landslides.
Yeah, which is remarkable. And now he's under attack from both the Democrats and the Club for Growth Republicans for ideological reasons from the left and right. But I don't know if he can survive a primary.
He's the original conservative, he says. When he's asked if he's conservative enough for Wisconsin in 2011, he says, I'm the original conservative. And that's a very interesting approach, but I don't know that it's going to satisfy the Tea Party. And they have choices.
Especially at a time, and remember in 2010, we had Scott Walker elected governor. We had Ron Johnson elected to the Senate. These are true believers, and these are not the kind of people who basically will welcome a Tommy Thompson, in a sense, a creature from the past.
A creature from the time when the two parties actually did, while they did a lot of warring, they also did a certain amount of working together.
Yeah.
Maybe a past that we will not revisit in 2012. It'll be a tremendously interesting primary, and it's a late one. It doesn't come until September, almost a year away. By the way, people who are kind of distancing themselves from the Republican Party of today, what's Lamar Alexander up to?
Well, that is interesting. Lamar Alexander from Tennessee, he is the third-ranking Republican in the Senate, the chairman of the Republican Conference, which is right under McConnell and Kyle.
Mm-hmm. And Kyle is retired.
He's retiring.
So there's a place to move up. Why is he moving out?
Well, I think he just feels that Lamar Alexander, when he was governor of Tennessee, when he ran for president, basically he was somebody who believed in compromise.
Not so much a moderate.
He's a conservative.
Centrist?
Well, he still talked to the other side.
Oh, the original conservative.
Well, Lamar Alexander was that kind of person, and he said, look, I am still going to run for re-election in 2014.
It's a very strange position that he's in, because he's saying, among other things, I'm disillusioned about being in leadership. You can't get anything done in the Senate if you're in leadership. Huh? I thought that's why people wanted to be in leadership. And number two, people are saying, well, you know, the real reason the guy stepping out of leadership is because he's not going to be allowed to step up. They want to move somebody else into the John Kyle seat.
Well,
somebody else named John Cornyn from Texas,
right,
after he wins a bunch of seats as the Senate Republican Campaign Committee chairman in 2012 and takes over the Senate.
And another John Thune, is likely going to replace Lamar Alexander as the number three Republican.
So he's essentially being, not exactly shown the door, but he's being told that he is not going to be getting any higher on the ladder. And so suddenly he decides the leadership is irrelevant. It'll be very interesting to see what he has to say about the direction of the party under Mitch McConnell, or, for that matter, the direction of the party in general in 2012.
But Mitch McConnell's not an ideologue either. I mean, he's somebody who's more of a technocrat, somebody who wants to get things done. Well, yeah, but look, he's conservative, but he's not an angry Jim DeMint litmus test conservative.
No, but he is talking much the way he has talked throughout his career. And the party has come around to his degree of conservatism and then gone beyond it. But he's comfortable enough with that. He doesn't really have to apologize for any of his politics. He can be a Southern Republican conservative, as he has been back to the 1970s.
Why does he retain the loyalty of his colleagues, whereas John Boehner seems to be openly defied left and right?
I'm not sure that he does have the loyalty of his colleagues. I think he is a more convenient fit with the Tea Party in the Senate. Now, another generation of newly elected Republicans in the Senate coming in after 2012 is going to probably be more like the 2010 Republicans than they're going to be like Mitch McConnell, and they may very well be a little bit more restive. Right now, More than 40% of the Senate has served less than 5 years in the chamber. That's an incredibly young Senate in terms of experience. And that's going to only get more so after 2012 because we're going to see a lot more seats change hands, mostly Democratic seats going Republican. And if there is a new Republican majority, it's going to be not only more conservative and more Tea Party oriented, but it's also going to be younger and less beholden to Mitch.
When you talk about new senators and young senators, being old as I am, I think of Charles Percy.
Who was once a young senator.
He was once a young senator who was once a rising star in the Republican Party. This guy elected from Illinois in 1966, defeating...
Oh, I know this. 66, Douglas?
Yeah, Paul Douglas.
Paul Douglas, Paul. Yeah. They actually, a legendary liberal, Paul Douglas.
Legendary liberal. I mean, this was an upset election in a very good Republican year. And once upon a time, they were talking about Charles Percy as the next Republican leader, if not a presidential candidate.
Oh, he was definitely talked about as presidential.
He was
material.
A favorite son in 68. He was basically going to run for president in 76, assuming Nixon filled out his term.
Yeah, but then there was the Ford thing, and then there was the Reagan thing, and there was no place for Chuck Percy.
Right.
The other thing is he is truly, in historical terms, anybody's era, a moderate
Democrat. Dove on Vietnam.
Democratish. Yeah. Sort of Republican, which was part of his charm in Illinois because he could compete well in the Chicago metropolitan area. But, of course, he would be totally out of step with the Republican Party of today.
And ironically, as chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in 1984, in a year that Ronald Reagan won 49 states, including Illinois, Percy lost to Paul Simon.
Simon. Right. Mm-hmm. And a campaign run for Paul Simon by...
Art Garfunkel.
David Axelrod, who went on to pick up another candidate at some point or another. So Charles Percy, 91 years old, died this week. Somewhat younger senator from another part of the country in another era and another ideology entirely, Malcolm Wallop, died this week at 78.
Now, Malcolm Wallop was also interesting because even though he was elected to the Senate as a strong conservative in 1976, defeating Gail McGee.
Gail McGee, a legendary senator from Wyoming.
Very centrist, kind of a conservative Democrat. 2 years before that, he ran as an environmentalist for governor of Wyoming as a moderate and lost.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how...
Yeah, he figured out. Well, of course, years change, and it was a year in which it was much more advantageous to run as a sagebrush rebellion conservative when he got elected, and he was really part of that whole energy into the Reagan era and through the Reagan era. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Time it was, and what a time it was, it was. A time of innocence, a time of confidences. Long ago it must be, I have a photograph. Preserve your memories, they're all that's left you.